Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Thank you for joining us on this, a very special edition of Beyond the Darkness, True Crime Tuesday Revisited. In the month of October, we're going to revisit some of our very favorite cases from our True Crime Tuesday archives. We're sharing some of the stories that you may not have heard, and if you have heard, you probably would like to hear again to re-examine the case files the way we are. Tonight's story is definitely one that is gripping and memorable. The name Adam Walsh resonates through the halls of justice because of his unfortunate abduction and murder. But that murder did not go in vain. As a matter of fact, it lit a fire under justice. His father, John Walsh, has become one of the greatest justice crusaders in history, and it is because of him and his drive and determination that criminals have been apprehended worldwide. It's created a bit of a phenomenon with America's Most Wanted. Tonight, we're going to discuss with Willis Morgan and Mia Taylor why they believe the real killer of Adam Walsh was Jeffrey Dahmer. That's right, Jeffrey Dahmer. There's been many cases and stories bandied about this crime, but to me, this was one of the most compelling episodes. And the evidence that they present is pretty compelling and pretty believable. It'll certainly make you re-examine this case. So sit back, enjoy, and I hope that if you like this, you'll try our regular True Crime Tuesday episodes, and you can subscribe to those by going to darknessradio.com and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. Every month, we deliver you 4 to 5 brand new 90 to 120 minute episodes of the best of true crime talk radio. We're very proud of the program. And by your donation of just $5 a month, it gets you 4 to 5 episodes, and that gets you access to all of the past archived episodes of the show as well, so you never have to miss another minute in the best of true crime talk radio. And everybody that subscribes right now between now and November 22nd is automatically entered into a drawing. So that's right, from November 22nd, 2017 and back, all the way to when we started doing True Crime Tuesday through the Patreon system, we're going to draw 3 names at random on the 22nd to win a 1-year paid subscription to True Crime Tuesday. So make sure you sign up for it now. We'll be drawing the names on the 22nd. We want to thank you very much for your support and love. And please sit back and enjoy this very special episode revisited here on Beyond the Darkness. Is the best in paranormal talk radio on a True Crime Tuesday. You're listening to Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim, this is a show that I have had an interest in covering and talking about since we began True Crime Tuesday 3 years ago. And because I was 1980s, I grew up in that period, and I remember this story so well. And I mentioned it on last night's show. On a long drive home to Illinois once, I rented the audiobook, John Walsh's book about his son, Adam, and his son going missing. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, it was one of the most compelling, terrifying, and heart-wrenching experiences you'll ever go through listening to a book. I mean, he's a fantastic speaker. And how he kept it together in parts of this book is beyond me. I mean, the man is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yep.
His son was kidnapped and murdered and beheaded. Terrifying. But if that isn't enough, as he's facing this down and talking with his wife, the police have to come and then tell him, well, we have to look at your best friend. And he's like, what are you talking about? Well, we might have a motive here. He's been having an affair with your wife. So now you've lost your son, your marriage, your best friend, all in one gut punch. And this man had some kind of fortitude because he stayed with his wife, remained friends with a friend, worked through this situation. Mm-hmm. Daniel J. Trevante was in the movie, the two TV movies. Joe Beth Williams, I think, played his wife.
Yeah, I believe so.
In the movie.
Yep.
And this story just absolutely terrified me, mystified me, and kept me enthralled the entire time. And the aftermath is unbelievable. As I said last night on the show, being a father of seven, if I lost one of my children to any reason, I don't know how I could soldier on. I just don't know how I could do it, in all honesty. This guy soldiered on and became a warrior for crime. And he went after criminals with a vengeance and started with America's Most Wanted, where they've caught thousands. And maybe you can look during the break. I'm interested to find out if there's a total tally of how many criminals they were actually able to help apprehend. I'm guessing in the thousands over the 15 years or plus that they were on. An amazing story, a fascinating story, but we may not have heard it all. Now, there's been different names that have popped up through history on who it could have been, and well, there's even a possibility that they think they may have closed the case, but our guest and another witness that are on the phone with us this evening believe they have a different take and a different idea of what happened that night. For those of you that are not familiar with the abduction of six-year-old Adam Walsh, we have an original actuality of the story kind of catching you up. So, Tim, if you've got that available.
In 1981, Adam Walsh disappeared from a Hollywood, Florida mall and later was found murdered. No one has ever been arrested or tried for this horrific crime. Here's a look back at the case.
He's our only child, beautiful little boy, and we just want him back more than anything. We have hope.
July 27, 1981. John Walsh's son, Adam, went to the store with his mother and tragically vanished.
Video games were brand new. There was one in the toy department of that store. He asked if he could stay there and watch two older sets of boys watching the video game. She went 2 aisles away. She came back 3 minutes later, 2 aisles away, and he was gone.
The older boys got in a fight, and all the kids, including little six-year-old Adam, were sent outside. 2 weeks after Adam vanished, police made a grisly discovery, finding his severed head 120 miles away. His body has never been found.
That's the terrifying truth of this case. For the next 2 hours, our guest, Willis Morgan, frustrated witness, the true story of the Adam Walsh case and police misconduct. Willis, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
This case, as I mentioned in the opening, has certainly caught the attention of the world. And boy, what an aftermath with pulling the pin on his father and becoming such an advocate for victims and helping crime as it has. When you were an eyewitness to this case, walk me through that day, if you don't mind. We heard him explain it in that news clip. Talk to me about your experience. Was it at a Sears? Is that where you were?
Yes, it was in Sears. But I would just like to say something about your opening there when you said that this was a different take on the case. This is not a different take or another take. This is Frustrated Witness, the book I wrote, is the true facts of the case. And
okay.
Not a take from me. It's from many witnesses. Mia, who you also have on, is just one of those other witnesses.
Great.
And I am also one of the witnesses.
And I understand that, but I didn't want to give away what police have believed. They closed this case, and they believe that they know who did this. You have a different take on that story because you were there and you saw what happened, and that's what I was referring to, giving you the perception or, you know, the perspective of having been on site and having been there as a part of this. So that's why I think it's fascinating, especially when it comes to police misconduct and how this case was screwed up. And they mentioned even in the news story that the police mishandled things during this case. So you're at Sears on this day in July of 1981. And what are you doing there that day? Are you roaming there? Were you there with a purpose? And kind of walk us through your day.
Right. Okay. Back in 1981, I was working for a newspaper, the largest newspaper in Florida, which is the Miami Herald. And we worked a four-day work week, 10-hour days, 40 hours. And I was off on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. So Monday was my middle day off.
Right.
And I had nothing scheduled that day, so I got up in the morning, and I decided that I was going to go to Walden's bookstore and then go down to the German deli and have lunch there. So that's the reason I went to the Hollywood Mall, because back then, that mall was the premier mall in our area. There was really only two malls in Southern Broward, and that was the Hollywood Fashion Center and the Hollywood Mall. And I went to Walden's. I parked at the east entrance. That's where the food court was. And I went to Walden's bookstore. I browsed around for about 20 minutes, and then I headed down to the German deli. But since Radio Shack was on the same side as the hall that I was on, I decided to go to Radio Shack and browse around in there first before I went to the deli. And while I was in Radio Shack, I had a bizarre encounter with someone in Radio Shack.
And this bizarre encounter, what took place at that time?
Right. Well, I walked into Radio Shack, and at the front of Radio Shack, like 15 feet in, they had a table, and it said red tag sale, and they had a bunch of items on the table, and had tags on them, red tags with prices, discounted prices on everything. So I was looking through this stuff, and this guy was standing at the entrance, and I wasn't paying attention, but in my peripheral vision, I noticed him standing there, and he came into that north entrance of the mall there, and just stopped at Radio Shack. And he was just standing there. So then I looked up at him, and sure enough, he was standing there staring at me. And then when I made eye contact with him, he put a big smile on his face, and he said, "Hi there, nice day, isn't it?" And I just didn't want to start a conversation, so I didn't even reply. And thinking he would just go away, too, because I knew once he say something that would, you know, just...
Right, you'd be engaging him, and right.
Right, but I didn't reply, and thinking he would go away, but he didn't go away. He came into the Radio Shack and came right up to me, arm's length, and again, with this smile on his face, he tried to engage me in conversation. And it became so bizarre and so intense that when he finally stomped out of Radio Shack... I don't want to waste the whole show just talking about my encounter. But it was really bizarre, and he stomped out, and I went to the Radio Shack entrance to look down the hallway, thinking that this guy is going to go up to someone else, and he's going to have the same encounter, you know, thinking that there would be I was thinking we were almost going to end up getting into a shoving match or a fight. That's how bizarre and intense this encounter was.
Right.
And I was thinking that would be repeated with someone else. And I was thinking they may need a witness, even help. So I was watching them. And then I passed the German deli. I never even had my lunch there. I saw him turn into Sears, and I went to the entrance there to watch what he was doing. I saw him walk to the west end of Sears, and he turned to the right and walked towards the toy department. When I walked down that way, I saw him actually turn into the toy department and disappear in the toy department. I stood there for a minute, wondering what he was doing there, but then thinking that he was probably just playing the video games and he would turn around and come back my way, and not wanting another encounter with this guy, I just turned around and left and went home. And it was that very same evening that I heard about this abduction. I was in the kitchen making a sandwich, and I heard on TV, I had the local news station on, I hear Hollywood Mall, and then I hear Sears, and then I hear an abduction of a small child, and then just the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I'm saying, my first impression was that guy did it, he actually did it, because I knew this guy was up to no good. He was a very, very dangerous person, because he was smiling when he was trying to talk to me, but he had this dead dull look in his eyes. Everything about him was very dangerous. And I don't follow people. I've never in my life followed anyone. This is the only time in my entire 70 years, before Adam or after Adam, that I've ever followed anybody. And that's how bizarre that was.
All right, well, let's...
I went to the police department. I told them what happened, but they completely dismissed everything I had to say because I didn't have a receipt to prove I was there, and I didn't get a tag number. All they wanted was a tag number of the vehicle.
So they didn't care that you saw what the suspect looked like.
Exactly.
They didn't care that you had, you know, specific details about this person and interaction with him.
Right. They didn't care about any of that. All he wanted was a tag number and proof that I was there.
Okay.
Why they needed this proof, I have no idea.
Well,
you
I'm going there
to tell him what happened, right. And all he wanted was proof.
Unfortunately, Willis, as I'm sure you've learned through history on this, a lot of people make a lot of claims when it comes to crimes like this to kind of inject themselves into the story.
Oh, yes. And it's happened in this case, obviously,
without a suit,
the person they pinned it on.
But, I mean, you know, there are, quote-unquote, eyewitnesses that will have seen something and sometimes send cops down the wrong pathway. So I understand to a degree why they want proof that you were there. That you know what's even more interesting to me, though, and is that if a man shows up, starts talking about this, and then doesn't, you know, shouldn't that have raised a red flag? They should have maybe at least investigated you a little bit, Willis.
Right, of course. They could have done that. I would have welcomed that, you know. But, I mean, what they did was they just totally dismissed me. They took my name and phone number and said, we'll call you if we need you. They never called me. And I've never went back to them because composites started showing up in the newspapers. And those composites were the spitting image of the person I had that encounter with. So my thinking at the time was, well, at least they have their composites. There's nothing more I can do. So I never tried to recontact them. I was thinking that was they had the composite.
With that said, let's bring in our other eyewitness at the time, and maybe you can introduce Mia and let us know how you came to find her and get to know her.
Well, I found Mia because her brother's name was in the case files, Joel. And I was looking for Joel. I spent, you know, a lot of time looking for Joel because Joel, according to the case files, may have been one of the kids in the toy department. And there wasn't much more information than that. But I tried to contact him. I found his address in Florida City, which is about 70 miles south of me and about 50 miles south of Miami. And I could get no response, so I drove to that house. I got no response. Nobody was ever there, so I left notes on the door, and I mailed letters. I've done everything to get a hold of him, but I never could get a hold of him, and I gave up. And until a book came out in 2011, which was called Bringing Adam Home. That's the book that was used to close the case, basically. Okay? And that was written by one of the detectives that was involved in the case since its inception.
All right.
And it mentioned Mia's name in there. And I didn't know at the time. All I saw that Joel had a sister named Mia, and I spent a lot of time tracking Mia down, and I finally found her, and that's how I met Mia. What she had to say was in complete contrast to what was in the book, because the detective that wrote that book, his name is Detective Joe Matthews, he leaves readers to assume that he talked to Mia. But when I contacted Mia, she says nobody's ever talked to her.
Fascinating.
And he, not only Mia, but other witnesses, too, that have passed away, he makes statements that Joel said to him. and that Mia said Joel did not say he would not have said. And Matthews consistently in his book uses people that passed away to say they made statements that they didn't make. For instance, Barry Grimilli. That's how he's the one that started and propagated that deathbed confession of Otis Toole. And he used witnesses like Barry Grimilli, who was the head person in charge of the infirmary where Otis Toole passed away at Lake Butler prison.
All right. Well, let's
says that he. Excuse me.
Okay. Before we get too deep into that, let's talk to Mia and hear her encounter, because I know she can't be here with us for the whole show. Mia Taylor, our guest as well. Mia, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to speak up for Adam.
All right. Walk me through this, Mia, your involvement in this case and what you saw. Were you also at the Hollywood Mall that day in Sears?
Yes. It was myself and my brother and my mother were all at the mall that day. And my mom...
How old were you?
Talked to one of her friends. Mia. I was 10 years old.
Okay, 10 years old, sure.
1981.
All right.
Actually, I was had just turned 10 a few months before. And my brother Joel was 9, but he was a lot bigger than me. He looked older than me. But I was like, okay, y'all guys can hang out here, because we were over in the toy department. And she went to talk to her friend that works in a store just outside of Sears. And so we were sitting there hanging out, and my brother and this kid, who I believe was Adam, was, you know, standing there talking and everything. And there were some older kids who were, you know, arguing and stuff, and they were basically like, you know, where's your mom? And so I'm like, my mom's right over there. And, you know, my brother and I started walking away, and that's when we saw Jeffrey Dahmer, this man who... Basically, I didn't know it at the time until back when Willis got a hold of me. He's handing me a bunch of pictures. He says, hey, look at these pictures and tell me if you identify any of these people that you saw. And I identified a particular picture. Anyway, back up a little bit. What got me is the man who we'd seen over by the toy department was seen also the day before, because we were in the mall on Sunday and Monday. Because like I said, my mom's got a friend who worked there. And, on Sunday, this same guy who I saw talking to this little kid when we were all leaving the toy department,
mm-hmm.
he had come up to my brother and was asking my brother about, he had like a little hole in the, it was the type of game, it was one that the ball just rolled around. It wasn't like a video game or anything like that. And
sure, it was one of those little handheld games where you had like a maze with a little silver ball in it, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Sure.
But my brother and I, we were walking down the hallway going back to where my mom was, and this guy stepped out in front of us. I mean, really weird closely, and I could smell alcohol in his breath. And he just looked not right, but he stops and he's looking at my brother only. I mean, there's two of us standing there, but he's concentrating on my brother. And he goes, do you know anything about this game? Can you help me play it or something like that? And I'm like, I've always been like real spunky, I guess.
Right.
But, and my brother is learning disabled, you know, so I was always protective of him. It's my little brother. But, I kind of was, no, he doesn't know anything about it. There's mom, let's go. And I grabbed my brother's arm and walked off. But the way this guy was just in my brother's face. Well, it was the very next day, which was Monday. We were there again, middle of summer. And, you know, it was, middle of the day, we were supposed to be getting with my mom to go and get lunch and everything. So anyway, we were leaving the store, and this same guy had this little boy. And my brother was like, hey, can I talk? Can I stand here with my little friend? And he goes, and my mom says, no, his dad's with him. And so we went ahead and left. And I saw this man holding the little boy by the tips of his fingers. And, he's telling him, he goes, you know, you're not my daddy, like something like to that effect. And we left. So we didn't hear about the case because we lived way further south. It was a few days before we heard about the case. But no one ever contacted any of us. Somehow Joe Matthews, as far as I know, they might have talked to my mom. I really don't know. But Joe Matthews, in, I guess, several years ago, had written this book saying that he had talked to my brother and he talked to me and that we had identified a specific person, and my brother said certain things, or that I said certain things, and I've never talked to Joe Matthews in my life. So that's all I know about all of it.
Interesting. And when you looked at these pictures that Willis gave you, did he show you a picture of Jeffrey Dahmer from 1981?
He showed me a picture of Jeffrey Dahmer from 1981, and it's not the same picture that the world saw on the news when he was arrested in Wisconsin. He looked nothing like himself. I personally had no idea it was Jeffrey Dahmer until Willis said, because he sent me an array of pictures, and I'm like, this is the guy I saw right there. He has a, you know, scruffy, kind of scruffy on his face, longer hair, and I had said, this is the guy, and he goes, do you know who that is? I said, no, but that's the guy I saw that day. That's who I saw. And as a matter of fact, that Otis Toole, his picture was in there, and I'm going, that's definitely not who I saw, because I had made a statement to my brother during, he and I were sitting there watching American Most Wanted one night, and they had had Adam's case on, and they had, had pictures of this Otis Toole on there, and I'm going, that cannot be that guy, because if that is him, the years have been awful on him, because he had way more hair, and I made a statement to that effect, and that statement was somehow given to Joe Matthews, because that statement ended up in his book, but it was twisted around as if I was identifying Otis Toole, and that was not the conversation I had with my brother. You understand?
Right. No, I understand completely. Mia, for just a few more seconds, you saw Adam Walsh with Jeffrey Dahmer. You saw them leaving the Sears, correct?
Yes, I did.
So you were an eyewitness directly to that. Right, the person that we believe to be Jeffrey Dahmer from the pictures.
The person I was shown the picture of in that array of pictures, and the one, that's who I saw that day. And I have a memory that just doesn't stop. So it's like, okay, I had no idea it was Jeffrey Dahmer until, because he'd emailed me these pictures, and then I'd emailed back, I think it's this one, and then he emailed me back. We were not even really talking on the phone too much, other than when he called, introduced himself. He said, are you willing to look at some pictures? And that's how I came to know Willis.
Have you ever considered, you know, Mia, in order to draw this story back to the attention and help blow this back up, have you ever considered suing for... suing the author, that former police officer that was part of the case, for not having spoken to you, not having a waiver to use the quotes you supposedly gave him? Because usually in those kind of situations, you have to sign like a release that you're giving this interview, you're doing these things for the book. And if you didn't do that, it might draw some attention and then at least get the attention back on the fact that if these facts are incorrect, maybe this case is worth opening again and taking a look at Jeffrey Dahmer as a very viable suspect in this crime.
I've never thought about suing anybody for it. I just figured, you know, eventually the truth would come out. And
that may be something you want to talk to Willis about off air. I don't know exactly where it stands, but I know when, you know, being an author of a book myself, I had to get releases from people that I quoted in the book and to use their photos or art or anything that, you know, their theories, their ideas. I had to get signed release so that, you know, I wasn't misrepresenting them. Right.
I did not even know that I was mentioned in the book until Willis told me, and I ended up getting a copy, you know, downloaded on my Kindle and started reading it. And he spelled our last names wrong.
Hmm.
You know, so maybe he was going off some fiction or something. I don't know.
Interesting. But, well, yeah, if there's never been an interview.
I never knew until Willis told me. And that was just in 2013 is when I found out about it.
Fascinating. Mia, thank you for coming on and sharing your insights with us. Is there anything else you wanted to share before we let you go? I know you're not here for the whole interview, but was there anything else about this case you wanted to mention?
No, I'm with Willis. You know, I'm frustrated at this point because the truth should be told and there should be justice for Adam. Basically, every suspect they've had is dead, but the truth should be known, and I, you know, feel like this Detective Matthews, he should be outed for the liar he is. because he has lied in this situation, and I personally don't appreciate it.
Well, then that is something.
I'm offended for Adam.
Right.
And he needs justice.
That might be, again, I would talk to an attorney about that and see, because it may help rouse the attention of everyone involved. And have you ever personally tried to reach out, Mia, to John Walsh about this story and about your non-involvement in this book?
No, I've actually really never talked to anybody except Willis.
Okay.
And now you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on this evening and sharing your insights with us and your personal account. And we appreciate the time. And again, please keep us in the loop if you end up doing something and looking into the legal aspect of this. Again, like I said, not necessarily looking to milk anybody out of money, but by regaining public attention to the fact that if he was misquoting eyewitnesses, that leads us down a different pathway altogether and should be reviewed, I think. So, Mia, good luck with that, and I hope that that might get some doors open again.
Yeah, something I might just look into, because at this point, like I said, somebody's got to make sure that the truth comes out.
Right. All right, let's...
I should not be allowed to walk around lying.
We'll let you get flying. Thank you for being a part of the show, Mia. And when we return, we'll talk more with our guest, Willis Morgan, the frustrated witness, the true story of the Adam Walsh case and police misconduct here on True Crime Tuesday. Willis, we just had a chance to talk with Mia, and she had quite a bit to share with that eyewitness account. I know there was some parts you wanted to add to that, so I'll let you jump in at this point.
Right. I just wanted to expand on a couple of things that she left out. And one is that Mia is not only a spokesperson for Adam, but also for her brother Joel, because he passed away in 2006. So he's not here to defend himself. And some of the claims that Matthew said, statements that Matthew said Joel made, that Mia definitely says he would not have made. And also, I would like to say that on that first day, Sunday, as Mia said, she was there 2 days in a row, Sunday, July 26, 1981, and Monday, July 27, 1981, on the same day Adam was abducted. On Sunday, Mia's mother showed up, as she said, and she ran to her mother when she felt like Dharma was about ready to grab her brother Joel. And not only her mother showed up, but also the security guard showed up, because, as Mia said, there was some conflicts with the kids arguing. So the security guard was called that day also. This is probably the same security guard, most likely, that they claim kicked Adam out of the store. That's Joe Matthews' story. He's the one that started that story, but that never happened anyway. But that same security guard that they say is responsible is probably the same security guard that may have saved Joel by showing up. As her brother was about ready to get abducted. Also, when they left the store on Sunday, she saw that same disheveled man, because when the security guard showed up, he split. He ran out of the toy department. And when on the way out of the Sears, she saw the same disheveled man standing next to a blue van. And there are numerous witnesses that have other accounts of a blue van and Adam being thrown into it and screeching off. And it was that same guy they all described.
All right.
So that blue van has not only been seen at the Hollywood Mall, but all three sites relevant to the Adam Walsh case were numerous witnesses. And that is, as we said, the Hollywood Mall. The second site is where Adam's severed head was found, 120 miles north of the Hollywood Mall. And four witnesses there saw the blue van there, and a white male. And also, at the site where Adam may have been murdered, I found the crime scene. And there are numerous witnesses that have a blue van there. That's where Jeffrey Dahmer worked, by the way. It was behind the store. The meter room where Adam may have been murdered is behind the store where Jeffrey Dahmer was working. And it was a blue van that was used for deliveries.
Now, you say it very matter-of-factly. Do we know, Willis, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jeffrey Dahmer was there in that city, in that state, at that time?
Yes, of course. There are police records with his name on it. And one of those police records is a report dated July 7th, has Jeffrey Dahmer's name all over it, but only as a witness to a murder, not as a suspect, because obviously in 1981 they didn't know who Jeffrey Dahmer was.
Right.
So what happened was he found a dead man behind the store where he worked.
Mm.
And, yeah. And his boss, Ken Halbert, the guy that hired Jeffrey Dahmer, he said that about 10 days after he hired Jeff, Jeffrey Dahmer found a dead man. And the date is July 7th. So what does that mean? That means if 10 days before, that would have been June 27th. 1 month exactly to the day when Adam was abducted.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
And was there, now, you also explained the blue van. Do we know if Jeffrey, you put Jeffrey Dahmer in that town, in that state at that time? As a matter of fact, you said a month before, Jeffrey Dahmer happened to find a dead man outside the back of the building that he worked at. And then a month later, Adam Walsh goes missing. Did Jeffrey Dahmer own a blue beat-up van at that time?
Well, he didn't own it. The blue van belonged to the owner of the stores. There were two stores. One store was Mr. Pizza. And the other store, they were 10 blocks apart, was Sunshine Subs. It was at Sunshine Subs where Jeffrey Dahmer worked. Okay? Now, the owners of those two stores, they own both of those stores, had a blue van and two white pickup trucks. And the blue van was used mostly for as a backup vehicle in the summer, the winter season when it was really busy. But this was the summer and it wasn't busy. So they didn't use the blue van as much as the pickup trucks for pizza deliveries because it used more gas. So they use it mostly to pick up supplies for the stores. And it would just be parked at the pizza place. And everyone knew it was there. Everyone had access to it, and everyone had access to the keys. Many of the employees that worked at those stores said they would take the vehicles and use them. Some would even go to Fort Lauderdale for the day, or even Orlando. And so everybody was using that blue van. Apparently, so was Jeffrey Dahmer. And there are numerous witnesses from those other sites that seen a blue van. There, including, like I said, where the severed head was found, there were four witnesses there that saw a blue van. What happened at the turnpike was 10 days after Adam was abducted, his severed head was found in a canal off the Florida Turnpike. And there were statements, phone calls. From the phone call logs, I saw some names in there of people that were calling in. There's numerous pages of these phone calls. But one call that stuck out to me was a truck driver that said he called the Hollywood Police Department on August 11th, the day after the severed head was found, and said he was a driver for the public supermarket chain, and he was heading back up north with an empty truck to pick up a full truck of groceries to bring it back down to South Florida. And at 12:30 in the morning on August 7th, he saw a blue van parked in the swale area of the turnpike, or on the shoulder, I should say, of the turnpike, and down by this little bridge on that canal was a man standing there with a white bucket, and he took something round out of the bucket and threw it into the water. He called the Hollywood Police Department and on August 11th and talked to a detective. He can't remember who the detective was, but he told that detective about a blue van at that site and what he witnessed about somebody on that bridge taking something down out of a bucket. And this is his quote, okay, of what that detective said to him. Yeah, yeah, we already know about the blue van. It has nothing to do with the Adam Walsh case. And in Joe Matthews' book, the book that was used to close the case, on page 26, he says of the blue van, all those blue van sightings, to me, were about as consequential as the sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. So obviously, these detectives don't want anything to do with this blue van, even though there's numerous witnesses that have seen it. And they dismiss all these witnesses, because at the time, these detectives had their suspect. And as you alluded to in the opening, it was John Walsh's house guest because he was having an affair with Rive, so they thought that would have been a good enough motive. And so he was their prime suspect. And also, he proposed marriage to Rive, but she turned him down because she had a son with Adam, with John Walsh being Adam. And so they figured, oh, you get rid of the kid, you get the wife. And, you know, that was all the motive they needed. And they harassed him for months on end until John Walsh hired an attorney known as the Silver Fox, because he was John Varon. He was Broward County's best criminal defense lawyer. And he sent letters to the Hollywood Police Department telling them that they are not to talk to James Campbell anymore without his presence. And so they dropped him finally after about 4 months as a suspect. But in the meantime, they were dismissing all the witnesses that were calling in from not only the Turnpike, but many other sites. Adam wasn't the only abduction, keep in mind. There were numerous other abductions. Adam may have been the only successful abduction that we know of, but the other kids all managed to get away because they were older than Adam. They were 10 years old. I think one was actually 3 years old, as young as three. And one was five, another one, and two more were 10 years old. But they managed to get away because their parents were nearby. And
it just didn't.
Trauma didn't succeed. But what I would like to talk about, one of those incidents was 2 weeks before Adam was abducted.
All right, we'll do that. We're up against the top of the hour break, so we have to go to break. Our guest is the author of Frustrated Witness, The True Story of the Adam Walsh Case and Police Misconduct. And he believes, as well as many of the other eyewitnesses he's spoken to, including Mia, who was just with us, that it was, in fact, Jeffrey Dahmer that abducted and mutilated the body of young Adam Walsh. We'll talk about the rest of the case, more of the story, when we return. You're listening to True Crime Tuesday. We hope you're enjoying today's very special edition of Beyond the Darkness True Crime Tuesday Revisited. We'll continue more with Willis Morgan and Mia Taylor as we hear the story of the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh. The very strange twists and turns that this story takes, you need to hear every moment of it, so make sure you stick with us.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back. Tonight, we are focused on True Crime Tuesday, talking about a case that has captivated the world for many years, since 1981, when six-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted from the Hollywood Mall back on July 27th, 1981, his severed head found at the Florida Turnpike. No one could have guessed what it would take police almost 30 years to find the culprit, or that even that they had still gotten it all so wrong. Willis Morgan, our guest, was an eyewitness at the mall the day Adam was taken. But rather than feel relief when the Hollywood Police Department finally convicted a suspect, he felt sick and frustrated. Let's, Tim, do we have that audio from the release? And I want to talk more with our guest about this, but this kind of plays nicely with the press release I just read. There was a news story, for those of you that have been following the case, where they claim to have wrapped this case up in a tidy little package with a bow. And let's go to that audio and hear what they had to say. Okay.
But let's get right to that breaking news out of Florida today. Police say they have finally solved the 1981 killing of six-year-old Adam Walsh. Adam's father is John Walsh, host of America's Most Wanted. And he gave a very emotional, gut-wrenching news conference just a short time ago where he told the story of 27 years of pain and suffering for him and his family as they waited for some closure in this case.
For 27 years, we've been asking, who could take a six-year-old boy and murder him and decapitate him? Who? We needed to know. And today we know. The not knowing has been a torture, but that journey's over. And a lot of horrible memories in this police department looking for that little boy. And now I think it's only fitting that it ends here in this police department. And there are a lot of good people here today. I always, for years, I tried to convince myself that justice delayed was not justice denied.
Ari Osder is from NBC's Miami affiliate WTVJ is here with us. So Ari, you know, here's John Walsh. He's helped so many families with unsolved murders and unsolved cases get their peace, and now his family finding justice. But why did it take so long to solve this case?
A number of reasons, Tamron, outlined by the current chief of the Hollywood Police Department, Chad Wagner, and he minced no words about it. He said, you know what, we made a lot of mistakes here over the decades, and we had a culture, he said, of trying to protect ourselves, protect our investigation instead of going where the investigation would lead, because they knew they made some mistakes. And some of those mistakes were that key pieces of evidence were lost. Back in 1981, they found a car, they found bloody carpet in a car belonging to this drifter with a history of violence against children. His name is Otis Toole. He was found in jail on some other crimes in Jacksonville. They connected this car to Otis Toole, and they thought, this is probably our man here. But they lost that evidence. With today's technology, that would have been conclusive, perhaps, evidence with DNA technology to see if the blood on that carpet was that of Adam Walsh's. That's one of the major mistakes they made. He also said they spent too much time going off on tangents on other potential suspects instead of concentrating on Otis Toole, who, as a totality of evidence now reveals, and they released all the evidence on CDs today of the entire case, the chief says, if you look at the entire case, one person stands out clearly as the man who did this, and that is Otis Toole. Toole died in 1996 in jail up in Jacksonville. They never got a deathbed confession from him, but he did confess several times to police about killing Adam Walsh, only to later recant those confessions. So there was always confusion about Toole, but the chief says there's no magic bullet here, no smoking gun document, nothing new as far as evidence, just that as a review of the entire case now shows clearly, he says, that everything points to Otis Toole, and investigators say if they had to prosecute him, if he was alive right now, they could take this court, take this case to court and win a conviction against Otis Toole. And it's also significant to note that from the very beginning, at least for the last 15 years or so, John Walsh and Reveille Walsh, his wife, have always thought that Otis Toole was indeed the killer here based on all the evidence that they were able to see in the case without even having the access to the entire case file that we now have.
All right, Ari, thank you very much for the update. Thank you.
And I apologize for the tinny quality, but that is an old story that we were able to dig up on this. Willis Morgan, our guest, again, was an eyewitness at the mall the day Adam was taken, as well as Mia Taylor. They both tell a totally different story, and they saw the man that they believe is the murderer and abductor of Adam Walsh. And when they released this information, the Hollywood Police Department finally convicting suspect Otis Toole in 2008, our guest felt sick and very frustrated. Frustrated that a young child was snatched from right in front of him. Frustrated that the evidence, leads, and witness testimony were lost. And frustrated that eyewitness testimony of Jeffrey Dahmer being at the Hollywood Mall the same day was simply disregarded. That's impactful, man. You hear them come out and John Walsh crying and feels like after 30 years, they got their man. And when they brought out that press conference, were you hoping that it was going to be Jeffrey Dahmer, or were you stunned when they didn't even bring up Dahmer's name in this case?
Of course. I was there at that press conference. I was right there, and there were numerous, all those videos you see, there were numerous videos because there were numerous media outlets from across the country at that press conference. And after that press conference, I tried to tell them the truth, but they were more interested in getting their story out than hearing the truth. And so they wouldn't listen to me. But anyway, let me explain to you what's going on.
Please. Really
quick, because we're getting short on time here. Okay. And not only did I see Jeffrey Dahmer in the mall that day on July 27th, 10 years later, I was at work. This was in 1991, almost 10 years to the week. And there was this article about something that happened up in Milwaukee in an apartment up there, and a story about all these bodies that were murdered in this apartment and dismembered. And there was a mugshot, and I started freaking out. I remember even saying out loud, "This is the guy. This is the guy I saw in the mall." I mean, it was a spitting image of him. I called the library up, our company library for the Miami Herald, and I asked them, "Listen, do me a favor. You remember that composite that ran in the paper of the suspect for the Adam Walsh case? Can you send me a copy?" And they did. I took that copy, along with the mugshot that was in the paper. I went back to the Hollywood Police Department, and as well as numerous other witnesses as well, going back to them now, when Dahmer made national news. And I showed them the composite, and I said, "Look, here's the composite, and this is the mugshot. You can see it's a spitting image. And we're on a radio show, so I can't show you that composite, but if everybody wants to see it, they can go to my website, frustratedwitness.com. I have copies of it there. And also I have another website, justiceforadam.com, where all the case files can be read, and a Facebook page titled Frustrated Witness. Anyways, I took that back to them, and the lead detective, Jack Hoffman, he was still on the case. He's the one I talked to, and his jaw dropped when he saw that composite. And I was thinking, he knows something, but he's not saying. But I didn't think any more of that, because I knew they don't discuss their case with people. So I let it go. And I didn't realize that what he knew that I didn't know at the time is that I had the wrong composite. The composite I had wasn't from the Hollywood Mall. As I told you, there were other attempted abductions. This was from the Twin City Mall on July 13th, another Monday, two Mondays before Adam was abducted. Okay? And this was in another Sears and another toy department at the same time of day. But this was the Twin City Mall, 60 miles north of the Hollywood Mall. Now, I didn't know that until 2008 when they closed the case that you were just alluding to. And also, when Jack Hoffman's jaw dropped when I showed him that composite, I believe that's when they went into cover-up mode, and that's when all the evidence grew legs and walked off, as you heard in that little segment you just did, where they say that it was lost. It wasn't lost. It was expunged from the case files, from the evidence room. And I knew in 2008, when they closed the case, I finally got a hold of the case files. And I started going through them. And that was at the time they closed, at that conference that you were listening to. As I said, I was there. They wouldn't give me a copy of it because they were only giving it to media outlets. I tried to tell them I worked at the Miami Herald, but another reporter already picked it up for the Herald, and they were only giving one copy out per media outlet. So I wasn't able to get one, but I had one guy that did get one. We went up to Kinko's, and I made a copy from his. And I started going through them, and that's when I realized that I had to, that wasn't composite. The library gave me was the wrong composite. It wasn't from the Hollywood Mall. It was from the Twin City Mall. And so I knew I had to contact those witnesses, and I did. And I contacted Ginger Keaton first, and she told me about the incident with her son, Terry Keaton. And they were in the mall, and this incident was, I identical to the Adam Walsh case, where a mother went to the mall with her son, and the son stayed back in the toy department. She was shopping aisles away. Jeffrey Dahmer came into the toy department, tried to abduct him, but he managed to get away, ran up to a couple people in the clothing department and literally clung onto this woman, Jane Hoover, and begged for his life, saying that, you know, that man was trying to get him. And Jeffrey Dahmer locked eyes with Jane and turned around and split from the mall. Ginger wanted to report this incident to security. And so she went out to the mall, and it was out in the mall hallway where Terry says, "Mom, that's the guy. Jeffrey Dahmer split from the Sears, but he went out into the regular mall. He didn't want to give up yet, apparently." And she said that never in her life did somebody give her a stare that put the fear of God in her. She was so scared, she grabbed Terry and just split from the mall, never reported it. 2 weeks later, when Adam was abducted, that's when she did go to the Riviera Police Department and report the incident. And as well as other witnesses, they were all calling the Hollywood Police Department as well. And John Atwater, that police chief from Riviera Beach, also called the Hollywood Police Department, telling them to get up there. They think that's connected to their case. So they did. They sent Jack Hoffman, along with another detective, Dennis Nylon, up there to investigate this. And they asked the Sears manager to give them a list of all the employees that worked that day, and he did. And they proceeded to interview all of them. But in the end, they dismissed all the witnesses because this is Jack Hoffman's statement, okay? And let me see. Okay, he said, Jack Hoffman said, "I put a lot of faith in the two incidents being related." That's the Hollywood Mall and the Twin City Mall. But the Hooverez, that's the witness in the clothing department that Terry clung on to, the Hooverez's composite didn't match James Campbell because that was their chief suspect at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they, instead of dismissing James Campbell, they dismiss all the witnesses. But you know what's so ironic about it? Those composites are spitting image of the composites from witnesses from the Hollywood Mall.
Right.
They didn't make that connection. All they did was dismiss the witnesses from the Hollywood Mall and the Twin City Mall and other locations. Like I said, there were others.
How frustrating.
And they continue to interrogate James Campbell as their prime suspect. So now, when I went to them in 1991 and they made that connection, they knew that they had to cover this up. You know, they say, when you mess up really bad, never fess up. And that's what they're doing. And that's, like I said, that's when all the artist true evidence, I believe, blew legs and walked off. It didn't, that's how it disappeared.
You know,
that's when it disappeared as well.
One thing we're a little curious about, and I'm just curious, Willis, if you've looked into this part of it. Jeffrey Dahmer seemed to have a type that he went for, and most of them were young men. And
yes,
it doesn't really seem to fit. Even his youngest deal, you know, his family home in Bath, Ohio, where supposedly his first victim was killed with, I think it was a barbell. They all fit a certain pattern all the way up to his, you know, being caught finally. How do you fit in the case of Adam Walsh and some of these other attempted young children abductions?
Okay. Now, you know, the book on M.O.s has been rewritten numerous times. You remember the D.C. sniper, right?
That was
a white redneck with a white van.
Right.
Remember? Well, they were so wrong on that. You know, M.O.s are just a general description. I mean, you can't put an M.O. on anybody. In Jeffrey Dahmer's case, his M.O. fit the times and the neighborhood that he lived in.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly black up in Milwaukee because he lived in a black neighborhood. In Germany, there were mostly women, and German women, of course, because he was in Germany. There were numerous murders over there right around the base where he was at. I mean, we don't have time. We're running out of time. I can't get into all these murders over there. But in Florida, there were mostly kids. And listen, there are no coincidences in murder. When you have all these sites, all these witnesses, enough to fill Yankee Stadium, saying it was Jeffrey Dahmer, with their composites matching him, their statements and descriptions matching him, blue vans all over the place matching. That's not just coincidence.
All right. And I'm with you on that. I was just curious because I know some of our listeners have thrown that question to me as we've gone along here. And it does, you know, it makes some sense if you've got, you know, a certain type. But you're right. And as I thought, you know, killers like this are opportunists. And
exactly.
They kill what they can. And if it was easier for them at that time. And you know, I was a child of that time frame. I remember constantly going to Kmart or Zayre's or Sears with my parents, and we'd immediately break at the door. I'll go to the toy aisle. You go do what you do. Find me in the toy aisle. That was always the case. Every one of us, you'd always just see the kids walking like zombies in the toy aisle looking for whatever new release was out. That's the way it was. You don't do that anymore, but that's the way it was.
Okay, but let me just also say how MOs can and murders can vary from, you know, an MO. Okay, now, that meter room that we talked about, okay, that derelict that Jeffrey Dahmer found, quote-unquote, dead, okay, and I'm certain, if you want to get into that, we can get into that because of the discrepancies in the police report of what Mr. Jeffrey Dahmer claims and what his boss said are in complete contrast. That derelict was 54 years old. And he was murdered in that meter room. Adam was 6 years old, and I believe he was murdered in that meter room. So Adam was his youngest victim, I should say, and that derelict, John DeBohemo, was his oldest victim. So you have a range from 6 years old to 54 years old.
Right, and it all fits. I mean, that's...
Not only does it all fit, listen, when we got a hold of this police report, in the police report, what it said about that derelict was that what happened was when Jeffrey Dahmer told his boss there was a dead man by his dumpster, Ken Halbert, Ken said that he said it in a very matter-of-fact tone. By the way, Ken, see, it was Jeffrey Dahmer's job to take out the garbage as a busboy at the end of the shift. So around 5 p.m., he was taking the garbage out. And he told Ken about the dead man. So Ken went out to check. Sure enough, there's a dead man there. So he calls the police. The police come, and they want to know who found the body. He says, my busboy. So they said, get him out of here. We need to talk to him. That's how he got his name all over the police record. And everything is in contrast to what he's telling his boss, for example, and what's in the police report. This guy had one shoe on. Jeffrey Dahmer said that Bobby was living in the meter room and that he was a derelict, he was a heavy drinker, and Bobby said he wasn't feeling well lately. And so the police looked in the meter room, and that's where they found the other shoe. He only had one shoe on. And I believe that when he dragged him out, when he took the garbage out, that's when he dragged him out to the dumpster. Because he couldn't have been out by the dumpster all day long. He had to be dead for a while because this is a pretty large strip mall. And all the stores use that one large dumpster to put their garbage in. And when I contacted that police officer that made that report out, he remembered that report. He remembered the derelict, but he didn't remember Jeffrey Dahmer. He said he was just one of many witnesses. In fact, he was flabbergasted when he was told that, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer's name was on his police report. And he said he remembered the derelict because he was covered in ants and in full rigor mortis. Well, that takes a while. And somebody... If he was murdered, if he died by the dumpster, somebody would have found him before the ants. So I believe he was murdered in the meter room. He might have been in there for even as long as a day in that meter room. And Jeffrey Dahmer took the garbage out and dragged him out there. So the police looked in the meter room. He only had one shoe on. That's where they found the other shoe. So I went in the meter room, and I started checking. And I'm telling you, the bumps on my arm, the goosebumps on my arm told me that's where Adam was murdered, and that's where he took Adam, because I knew this was the guy I had an encounter with. There was no question. Believe me, when you have an incident that bad that leads to a murder of a six-year-old, it's something that gets embedded in your brain. You never get it out.
Right.
And I remember this incident like it was yesterday. So do all the other witnesses.
Well, and it's important, too, you know, to realize that when they did capture Jeffrey Dahmer, he had multiple heads in his house.
Absolutely.
He liked to decapitate.
Yeah, and Adam was decapitated. And Otis too never decapitated anyone. And also, let me say, you know that July 13th incident that we talked about?
Right.
If you believe those composites that match the Hollywood Bowl, as I've said, and the witness statements, and I would love to get Ginger on another show with you, but if you believe these people, that these two incidents, among other incidents, all connected, Otis too wasn't even in the state of Florida. He was in a hospital in Newport News, Virginia, and didn't arrive in the state of Florida, never mind not even Hollywood, Jacksonville, more than 300 miles north of Hollywood, on late afternoon of July 25th. He was carless and penniless. He had no way to get back to Jacksonville. He couldn't even buy the bus ticket. He had to go to the Salvation Army, and they gave him money for the bus ticket. And there's a phone call to prove that. At 3:30 on Friday night, he made a phone call from that Salvation Army. It's on the record. They have the record of the phone call because one of the requirements to get that bus money for the bus ticket is that he has to show when he gets to Jacksonville that he's going to be employed. He's going to have work.
Right.
So he called a former employer, and they said they would re-employ him as a roofer, which is the work that he was doing. He was working for South Coast Roofing or something like that. And they verified that before they gave him that bus ticket. Actually, they gave him a check that was made out to Greyhound for the amount of the bus ticket. And Greyhound cashed it and gave him the bus ticket, one-way ticket to Jacksonville. When he got to Jacksonville, like I said, he was carless and penniless. He didn't have that car till like over a year after he was in Jacksonville. He had absolutely nothing to do with this. This was Detective Joe Matthews who perpetrated that hoax on everyone. Joe Matthews is one of the original detectives. How he got involved in the case, because he wasn't even a Hollywood police detective. He worked for the Miami Beach Police Department, but he also had his own company called Southern Polygraph, Southern Institute of Polygraph. And they hired his company, the Hollywood Police Department, to polygraph the Walshes and James Campbell, which he did. And he exonerated the Walshes and three times exonerated James Campbell. And all these detectives were fighting over that because they didn't want James Campbell to be exonerated. They wanted him to change the conclusion and at least say it was inconclusive. And so they were fighting like cats and dogs over there at the Hollywood Police Department. So anyway, when John Walsh got his TV show, America's Most Wanted, when he became host of it, this detective, Joe Matthews, heard about that. He calls John Walsh up, and John Walsh remembered that he's the one that gave everybody the polygraphs and eliminated them. He hired Joe as the senior lead investigator. See, this is what a lot of people don't realize. He was a senior lead investigator on that show, America's Most Wanted. So John Walsh had one of these detectives right in his midst for years, feeding him false information about his own son's abduction.
We were just talking, Willis, about how just poorly this was all handled, and eyewitnesses were excused and blown off because in their eyes they already had their guy, they already knew where they wanted to go, and they as you said, you had enough eyewitnesses to fill a stadium, and none of them were taken seriously.
Right. You know, as I said, you know, some police departments, they have a tendency when they mess up not to fess up.
Right.
And Milwaukee Police Department is doing the same thing. Let me just say about Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, he's credited for 17 murders, correct?
I believe, yeah. There's 17 around there, right.
But there's others that they don't want to make the connection to because there could have been riots in Milwaukee, like Ferguson. Okay. One of the victims from Jeffrey Dahmer escaped Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. That was a little Laotian kid named Samantha something. I'm botching his name up, I'm sure. But he was a 14-year-old Asian child that escaped from Dahmer's apartment. What Dahmer did was he drilled a hole in this guy's head and with a turkey basting needle injected muriatic acid into his brain, trying to make a zombie, a living zombie. And this is one of his experiments that he was doing. And he thought his experiment was working pretty good, so he left and went out to go drinking. But his zombie escaped, and he was walking around in a trance on the street, 20, I think it was 25th, butt naked. These two black girls, 17 and 18 years old, saw this kid. They call 911. The police arrive. And then who shows up? Jeffrey Dahmer on the way back from the bar. And he's telling the cops that this is his 19-year-old lover. And the girls are protesting, saying, no, he's not 19. Look at him. He's just a child. And the cops tell the girls, they said, listen, take off or we're going to take you downtown. They did not want to hear it because they claim, as well as the black community claimed that back then, the police did not want to listen to a black person over a white person. They believed Jeffrey
right.
Dahmer. They handed the kid back to Jeffrey Dahmer, and Dahmer immediately killed that young boy and severed his head and boiled his head and kept the skull as a trophy. Okay. Now, that was after he was captured, before they realized what happened, that kid was given back to him. And there was also another murder case, in fact, several of them, that were open cases, open homicide cases. One of them was were in Jeffrey Dahmer's own building where he lived. And the police knew those homicides, especially the one from Dean Vaughn, had to be somebody within the 49 units of the Oxford building because they had a locked door. You needed a key to get in. And if you were a visitor, you had to use the intercom system to be buzzed in. Okay, so they were certain. They went to everybody. They interviewed everybody, including Jeffrey Dahmer. And when they were in Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, they asked Jeffrey Dahmer if he knew the guy. Jeffrey Dahmer said, no, he don't know him. And they asked if he could search his apartment. He said, you can search all you want, but they never searched his apartment. If they did, they would have found a dead body on his bed. And they left, and that was an open homicide. And that's not the only other time they were in that building. They were in that building numerous times for all the stench calls and other things that were going on in that apartment. Now, Dean Vaughn was found in apartment 308 on his bed, drug strangled and sodomized. He had his pants pulled down to his ankles, and he was laying dead on his bed. So after Jeffrey Dahmer was captured for all those murders in his own apartment, that's when everything started coming together. But the police never wanted to make the connection to Dean Vaughn. When they interviewed Jeffrey Dahmer, they asked Dahmer, as I said, if he knew Dean Vaughn, and Dahmer insisted still that he didn't even know the guy. But I've called other residents in that building, and they swear Stringbean went into, oh, that's Dean Vaughn, they called him Stringbean, went into Dahmer's apartment, and they seen Dahmer going into his apartment periodically. So that was a lie. Dahmer lies all the time, but they believe his lies because they want to. They don't want to make connections. And the manager also told me that Dahmer's been in his apartment with a six-pack trying to get him to drink, but he was the manager, and people would come in, either friends or somebody to talk about an apartment, and so Dahmer didn't like company. He would just split. Three times that happened, and he believes Dahmer was trying to murder him as well because he was giving Dahmer a hard time, but all the stench. In fact, one time he went to Dahmer's apartment and to check and see what was stinking so bad, and he saw this blue barrel in Dahmer's bedroom. He said, what is this? And Dahmer opened it up. It happened to be empty, but the fumes, he said, almost knocked him to the floor. It stunk so bad. So he ordered Dahmer to get rid of it, and he's going to be back in an hour to check. Well, before he got a chance to go back to Dahmer's apartment, Dahmer went to the office and said, listen, I want to take you to the dumpster and show you something. He takes him to the dumpster, and he shows him the blue barrel. He got rid of it. So that ended that. But that was the same blue barrel that was seen being removed from his apartment after he was captured and had four torsos in it. And it was filled with muriatic acid. So obviously he went and retrieved it. But the police, they just don't want to make the connections. In the same way as Miami. They don't want to make the connections to Jeffrey Dahmer because it would make them look more horrendous and more miserable, the investigation of the Adam Walsh case, than anyone could imagine.
Thank you for checking out today's Beyond the Darkness True Crime Tuesday Revisited. It's a gripping and terrifying tale. Did Dahmer kill Adam Walsh? Willis Morgan and Mia Taylor believe so, and they're here to continue sharing their story and some of the most bizarre evidence collected to prove this story. So stay tuned. We got more of that. And remember, you can subscribe to our regular True Crime Tuesday podcast, available every Tuesday. And you can listen any day of the week. Once you subscribe, you can check it out every day of the week. Plus, go back and check out our archives that are all on the site going back this past year. 4 to 5 episodes every month, only $1.25 per episode. It comes out to $5 a month. That's all we ask to give you some of the best in true crime talk radio. Help and subscribe right now. And your name will be entered into a drawing so that on November 22nd, we're going to do a drawing. 3 people will be picked at random to get 1-year subscriptions to True Crime Tuesday, but you have to be signed up from the beginning of our True Crime Tuesday through my birthday, November 22nd, to be eligible for this. So go sign up now. You can do it at darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner to subscribe. Never miss another minute of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis bring it to you weekly on True Crime Tuesday. Hey, listen, we know that things can be scary. True crime, supernatural. Sometimes there's nothing more chilling than setting foot on a car dealership's lot. That's right, because you don't know what to expect. You're going in with preconceived notions, some fears, some trepidation. Well, what if I told you that I could help you and take away all of that fear? Well, I personally can't, but my friends at True Car can. Listen, they've got over 3 million cars sold, over 13,000 dealers nationwide, and over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available right now. And you can get an average savings of over $3,000 off the manufacturer's suggested retail price. What's scary is that you're not getting the best value and you're not getting the best deals. Now you've got to sign up, become part of True Car, and you'll get the most comfort you've ever had getting a car. You're going to get a fair price. You're going to get pricing context, information that empowers you to feel confident. With True Car, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. From there, you can connect with the local True Car certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Again, with over 13,000 dealers nationwide, there's a dealer everywhere that can help you out, whether you're looking to buy a new or previously owned vehicle. They're going to show you what other people are paying for that vehicle in the area that you want. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident when you step on the lot. And once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a True Car certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before going to the dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. And with True Car, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick and easy buying experience. True Car customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with True Car certified dealers. And True Car users save an average of $3,000 off the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So take the word of your old pal Darkness Dave. When you're in the market for a new or previously owned vehicle, check out True Car. Sign up for it right now. You'll be thankful that you did. You are hitting some nerves, I will tell you, Willis. We are getting pounded with emails and comments on my emails on my Facebook and private emails here on Darkness Radio. People are absolutely enthralled with what you're sharing this evening. What I'd like to do, as I mentioned you off air, I will invite you to join me as my guest for a full 4 hours on Coast to Coast in June, and it'll give us a chance to flesh this out more. And I think we're also going to try to invite, with your okay, I think we're going to try to invite the officer on the show, Detective Joe Matthews, and see if he'd like to come on and talk about the other side of this, and see how easily or what kind of struggle there is in shooting either one of these sides down. So if you'd like to do that, we'd love to have you, Willis.
Yes, and I would like to do that, but I can tell you now, Joe Matthews will not show up, but what he might do is have Les Standiford fill in for him. Les Standiford is an English professor who wrote the book for Bringing Adam Home for Joe.
Sure.
And that's probably what he will do. And I'm going to tell you what he's going to do, because he's already been doing this on other sites. My Facebook page, I had to ban him. Other sites had to ban him, because all he's doing is being obstructive. All you have to do is go to Amazon.com or go to my website, FrustratedWitness.com, and I put the one-star book review titled A Joke of a Book, referring to my book, and I put that there. You can read it, and you can also read my response. And he's been, and other people that write reviews on Amazon, he writes comments to them, you know, debunking me, and he'll pick one discrepancy and one by one eliminate every witness, you know? And this is exactly what the police department did. And this is how they eliminate all the witnesses. You know, they say if you have 10 witnesses to an accident, you're going to get 10 different versions.
Right.
That doesn't mean they aren't genuine witnesses and they weren't there. But this is what they will use, all those discrepancies to dismiss one by one each witnesses. And this is what they will attempt to do if you get them on the show. And if you want, that's up to you. I don't mind them being on the show, but I'm just letting you know what they're going to attempt to do. Now, let me just tell you about these detectives in the Hollywood Police Department. Why, as we told about Milwaukee Police Department and the Hollywood Police Department, things that they don't want people to know, and that's why they cover up. One of the other witnesses, this guy's name is Vernon Jones. He was 9 years old. He was a young black boy. He was also playing the video games with Adam for a short time. He was playing an Atari baseball game with Adam. And there was this guy standing to his left, hissing at him, like, psst, psst, hey, you, come here, like that. And he looked over to this guy thinking to himself, man, I'm not going with you. And just then he heard a big crack. It was Adam. He just got a Grand Slam home run. And Adam looked at him with this big smile on his face. Now, being an older kid at 9 and Adam being only 6, he was upset by getting beat by the 6-year-old kid. So he just left and went on to the other side of the aisle and started playing Donkey Kong by himself and left Adam there with this man. And he saw this man walking by with Adam hand in hand going out the exit. So this is another witness. Now, when he was home, he was with his grandfather, visiting his grandparents who live in Hallandale. And his grandfather works in the lawn care business, so he went to Sears to the tool department. Vernon, not being interested in tools at 9, stayed in the toy department. And that evening, they called Vernon to the living room and said, Vern, get in here. You at the Hollywood Sears toy department. Did you see this boy on TV? And Vern looked at him and said, Grandpa, that's the boy I was playing the video game with. So the grandfather took him the very next morning to the Hollywood Police Department. They never made it inside because there was a heavyset white male police officer at the entrance. He went up to that police officer to inquire about the case, and that police officer turned to his grandfather, spat a wad of tobacco on his grandfather's shoe, and said, Boy, I ain't got time for this. Vernon says to this day he remembers pictures of that tobacco splattering all over his grandfather's shoe. So his grandfather took Vernon by the hand and left. Mm. He wouldn't hear from Vernon until he grew up in his 20s when he wrote America's Most Wanted a letter, you know, telling him how bad he feels about this. And he was only 9. He didn't understand. And the America's Most Wanted forwarded that letter to the Hollywood Police Department telling them to contact this witness and to interview him and call him. To this day, they've never interviewed him. And they've done that with many witnesses. They've never interviewed. They refuse to interview some of these witnesses.
Hmm. Makes no sense. You would think with as much of an advocate for justice that John Walsh is, that he would want the answers. He would want this finally to come out and be justice for his son.
Exactly, but he does. That's the whole point. Except he's got these detectives right in his midst who he considers Joe Matthews his best friend and colleague.
Right.
Telling him that, you know, I'm just out this for in this for whatever other motives that he makes up to John, that there's no validity to anything I'm saying. But it's not just me. He doesn't mention that there's many witnesses. Like I told you, there's a Yankee Stadium full of witnesses. I just mentioned a couple of them here, Vernon Jones and Ginger and her son, Terry Keaton, and, you know, Mia that you talked to. That's only the tip of the iceberg. There's many witnesses.
He
never called any. The only witnesses Joe ever called when he put his manuscript together were Otis Tool's cellmates, and they would say things that, yeah, of course we know he did it. Everybody around the prison knows Otis Tool did it.
Hmm.
That's not evidence. You know, this is the kind of witnesses he called. And then other witnesses like Barry Grimilli, you know, who passed away, and he just makes up what Barry said. And I know that for a fact because I have Barry's interview in the state attorney's files, which you can read on my website, justiceforadam.com, where Barry says that I was watching this TV show, and I saw John Walsh come on and say something about a deathbed confession, and that just isn't so. That just never happened. Otis Tool never talked about the Adam Walsh case or any other case. He never opened up to anybody.
Right.
Joe Matthews is saying that he interviewed Barry, and Barry's telling him about this full confession Otis Tool was making. Well, you know, I mean, either you believe Joe Matthews and what he says after somebody passed away, or you believe the interview that he gave that's on record.
Why do you think Otis Tool would make repeated admissions to this only to renege them again?
Right, because Otis Tool wasn't the only one. There were numerous suspects that were confessing. The problem is they eliminated every single one of them, okay? Mostly because they were able to pin down the day they were on July 27th. Now, Otis Tool, in the beginning, they couldn't pin him down where he was, but except within a day and a half. Like I said, he arrived back on the 25th of July. Adam was abducted on the 27th. Okay, so the other suspects were all eliminated, and you know, the reason they confess is to get field trips, like Otis Tool got. Now he got a field trip to South Florida, but he, you know, according to Jack Hoffman, you know, all the original detectives dismissed Otis Tool within 4 months. You know, Detective Hoffman is the only one. And of course, the police chief, because he convinced the police chief to call the case. What he did was he wrote up a 400-page manuscript, okay, pinning this on Otis Tool, and he gave it to the police chief and convinced him to close the case. Which the police chief did. Now, the police chief knew it wasn't Otis Tool when he closed the case. They only did this because they knew they can get away with it. They go after the downtrodden. They pin murders on them because they have no education, no family, no money, you know. And in Otis Tool's case, they do it posthumously. After he's already passed, he can't even defend himself. And they pin murders on him just to make themselves look good.
Right.
Now, whether Detective Hoffman did this for egotistical reasons, or whether to placate the Walshes, or whether just stuck on stupid, or a combination of everything, you know, he pinned the murder on somebody that was an innocent man. Had nothing to do with this. Now, I have all the original statements from the other detectives. Now, this is the second lead detective on the case, Detective Ron Hickman.
We only have 30 seconds left, Willis.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll do this on the next show.
Right, and we've only scratched the surface.
But if they want more information and you don't have the money to buy the book, you don't want to buy the book, go to my website, frustratedwitness.com. You can, from there, you can go to Amazon and look at the book, read the comments and the reviews. And also, I have a Facebook page, Frustrated Witness, and I have another website where all the case files can be reviewed. And that's justiceforadam.com.
JusticeForAdam.com. Willis Morgan, our guest this evening. Thank you so much for joining us, Willis. And I look forward to a deeper, longer conversation with you in June on Coast to Coast AM. That's it for tonight on Darkness Radio. Take care, be safe, be kind to one another, and always keep your eyes open. Watch for what's going on around you. You never know what you may witness. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is True Crime Tuesday.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At WashableSofas.com, you'll find the Anabe Sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash, perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.